Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Exit buying opportunity. As political tensions weigh on UK stocks, none other than Merrin Somerset Webb makes the case for unloved UK equities. Who are the biggest winners and losers on the FTSE this year? Russ Mould from AJ Bell joins me to run through the list. And is the Small Claims Court a better bet for claiming redress than the Ombudsman Service? Welcome to the FT Money Show, the FT's weekly podcast about personal finance and investing. I'm Claire Barrett, FT Money Editor, bringing you all of this week's money news. Merrin Somerset Webb, our columnist, requires no introduction from me, quite frankly. She was pretty much a lone voice in the FT before the referendum as a columnist who advocated voting leave, and her column in FT Money last week about how she became a Brexiteer has attracted a record-breaking number of comments, even by Merrin's standards. So she joins me on the line now to talk about how she thinks the disruption that many fear lies ahead for us in 2019 could actually translate into a possible buying opportunity for investors in UK shares. Welcome, Merrin.
Hi, Claire.
So I'm just going to read out the intro to your column for anybody who is stupid enough to miss it at the weekend. You say, in early 2015, I spent an hour interviewing Nick Clegg. He turned me into a Leave voter. Discuss.
He did. I mean, I'm using poor Nick here as a representative of a different way of thinking to my way of thinking. You know, one of the things that we talked about in that interview is, back in 2015, he was talking about the way it is in the modern world, there's so much that you can't control with the national government. So you can't control global trade, you can't control international crime, you can't control climate change, et cetera, et cetera. All these things, he says, have to be dealt with by a global decision-making body, not Westminster. And he used this phrase when we were talking. He said, you know, Westminster is basically a fictional universe, one in which lots of people think they have loads of power, but really, in fact, most power has either been shoved up or shoved down to the local level. And so, you know, people who feel that they're in charge of countries aren't really in charge of countries. Now, and my view on that is different. Nick thinks that that is an inevitable and perfectly reasonable way for the world to go. But I don't think that in the main works for people. It's absolutely true. Of course, you have to have global cooperation on these big issues. But what you can't have, I think, if you want people to remain happy inside their democracies, is global agencies telling people what to do, telling them you must do this, you have to do this, and your national government is secondary to our organization. That doesn't work for people. It doesn't work for me, and I don't think it works for an awful lot of other people around the world as well. This kind of globalization or globalization of authority that takes over democracy. So there's a disagreement here in the way that people think about how the world and how nations should be governed. And it was my conversation with Nick that clarified these thoughts for me, made me realize that I don't want a global government of any kind. I really do want to continue to live within a self-governing nation state that cooperates on big issues rather than is ordered around on big issues. So that's the difference, and that's one of the sort of core drivers between my original vote for Leave.
And just expanding that slightly for investment purposes. Another one of these big global forces which has been dominating us for nearly a decade now has been the central banks and their program of quantitative easing after the financial crisis. Now, you say in the same column that move from QE to QT, quantitative tightening, has been one of the biggest changes for investors.
Well, absolutely. And one of the things I say in the column is let's try and think, and very few people who commented on this article, by the way, agree with me on this, but what I wrote was, let me ask you to think of the EU as being the governments rather as quantitative easing as to fund managers, something that does a lot of the heavy lifting for you, whether you want it to or not, leaving you to grandstand around the edges so you think you have power, but actually most of the real decisions are outside your control, taken by somebody else. And that's exactly what has happened with QE, in that over the last 10 years, this has been the only really important thing in markets. how much money is being printed, how's it working, how's it transmitting its way to the market, and that's pushed everything up. I mean, it's really unusual, remember, to have stock markets, in fact, all asset prices, give or take, go up for 9 years in a row. Mm. This doesn't happen very often. It's happened over the last 9 years, until this year, obviously. And that has meant that, you know, most fund managers have done just fine without really having to do anything at all. Now, the withdrawal of that dynamic is, you know, pretty much the same as the withdrawal of an external government for a country. Suddenly, you're on your own. You know, now you have to make genuine decisions, genuine stock picks, genuine asset allocation decisions, because everything is not just going to go up anymore. Now, a bear market doesn't necessarily mean you can't make money. Of course it doesn't. What it means, a proper bear market, means that there are opportunities to make money, but you can't make money in absolutely everything. That's all it means. It's not necessarily a bad thing. And of course, if we are long-term investors, we should be thrilled to see stock prices coming down and all asset prices coming down, because if we believe, which I think we all do, that the most important factor in the returns that you will make in the future from an asset is what you paid for it in the first place, the less you pay for it, the better. So, you know, we mustn't get ourselves too hysterical about the normalization of monetary policy leading to a normalization of valuations in the stock market. This is not a bad thing, necessarily.
And one of the areas of value that you think could really emerge in 2019 is the Brexit-battered UK.
Well, absolutely. I mean, sterling is cheap. Look at it on the Big Mac Index, and it's one of the cheapest currencies out there, Big Mac Index being, you know, how much does a McDonald's cost in every currency. And the market is cheap as well. And this is, it's a very emotional issue, you know, people pulling money out of the UK because they are worried about Brexit. But of course, they're not just worried about Brexit. They're also worried about Brexit chaos leading to a Corbyn government. So there's two stages of frantic worry here. And I suspect that a Corbyn government is more worrying for equity investors, perhaps, than Brexit is. But nonetheless, whatever people are worrying about, they are pushing down UK equity prices well below equity prices elsewhere. So you're seeing very, very low levels of investor confidence. There's a Hargreaves Lansdown investor confidence index that I was looking at and I mentioned in the column, but it only goes back 10 years. So, you know, maybe it's not at its bottom yet. It's at 52, 10-year average being 94. So low, but maybe it'll go lower. Who knows? And anyone who's looking property at valuations is telling us that UK equities may be something in the region of 30% cheaper than they should be relative to other markets, which doesn't mean they won't go down further, because other markets might come down further. But the key thing is that we have an excellent yield. The UK market as a whole is yielding just under 5%. Not all those dividends are going to last. Of course, some of them are going to fall. But even so, that's a great yield relative to the rest of the world. So while you sit around and wait for your value buys in the UK to come good, at least you're getting paid for it.
And I should mention that in this weekend's edition of FT Money, we're hearing more from you in the form of our annual investment outlook debate for 2019. Now, a couple of cheeky acronyms for listeners at home. We talk a lot about FOMO, the fear of missing out, versus FOMMEL, the fear of losing money, because one of the chief concerns of people in the room was, is this gigantic 30-year bull run essentially in stocks now going to come to an end with the turn that we're seeing in the bond market, or could there be one last hurrah?
Oh, well, we did talk about that, didn't we? There's always a chance of one last hurrah, but should there be a last hurrah, this is probably a good time to sell rather than a good time to buy more. So, you know, who knows? It's entirely possible that if we get from the Fed the suggestion that rates aren't going to rise as much as one previously thought, or that things are going to soften on the monetary front, then you may well get one last bite at the cherry of this great bull market. Overall, I don't think there is any doubt that this huge market of the last 30 years, and in particular of the QE-driven last 10 years, is beginning to turn. You know, lots of things are turning at the moment. It's not just economics, it's not just markets, it's politics as well. We are this, you know, 2017, 18, 19, 20, I think are really going to be, or have been, and are going to continue to be very exciting years, both economically, financially, and politically. Not always in a good way, by the way. Exciting doesn't necessarily mean good, but they're fascinating years where we're seeing the pendulum swinging from one extreme to another extreme. History moves slowly. It'll take a few years, but I think it's a really fascinating time.
Well, thanks very much there to Merin Somerset-Webb, our marvellous FT Money columnist. You can read this week's column from Merin, which offers something different, recommendations of Christmas books to buy investors. There's still a few days to go. And you can also read the full write-up of the 2019 investment debate I was just referring to online at ft.com/money. UK investors are notorious for their home bias, investing in companies listed on the UK stock market. But frankly, can you blame us, given how international the FTSE 100 index has become? For much of this year, holding the index, perhaps in the form of a cheap tracker fund, has been one way of trying to hedge against sterling weakness, thanks to the currency translation effect on those foreign earned dividends. But now, wide of global market worries are weighing on the FTSE 100, and here to talk us through some of these ideas is Russ Mould, the Investment Director at AJ Bell.
Hello,
welcome,
Claire.
Russ. Well, it's great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
But sadly, a bit of a torrid year for the FTSE 100.
I'm not the bearer of the best tidings necessarily, no. FTSE 100 down around 13% for the year now. Multiple reasons. You mentioned global economic worries being a very, very big one, whether you equate that with Trump trade and tariffs, or whether you equate it with fears over central bank policy being tightened too quickly and putting the crimps on the global economy. And I will mention Brexit once there, because it is a concern. The UK has actually been the worst major geographic performing region since the June referendum in 2016. So whatever your opinions on Brexit, whether it be good, bad or indifferent, I'm not expressing any on behalf of myself, my employer or the Financial Times, it has, for the moment at least, been weighing on UK equity performance, it seems.
Well, if we delve a little into the detail of the top risers and fallers on the FTSE 100, it certainly shows a very mixed picture. I mean, do you want to tell us what the number one stock on the FTSE 100 is? Because I feel it's a company that many of our listeners will appreciate.
It's Ocado, and I'm a long-standing Ocado customer of some 10 or 12 years, and I love it because they've barely made a profit, so they're subsidising my dinner as far as I'm concerned. So I'm in love with Ocado. But in terms of the current index constituents, it's up 95% for the year. The slight wrinkle is it only came into the index in June.
Yeah.
So if you want to go back to the best performer in the index from January, it's actually Sky, which was acquired by Comcast in that Megabucks deal back in the autumn. That finished the year up 70%. GKN, no longer in the index because of the Melrose bid, that's up 51%. So they're actually the best two from the start of the year. But from where we are now, the best performers are Ocado, Evraz, and actually Pearson, the former owner of this August newspaper, no less.
Yes, I'm sure there are many colleagues who have still held on to their residual Pearson shareholdings who will be pleased about that. But we should also mention the biggest losers on the FTSE.
Yes, in the current index, it's British American Tobacco, down 49% after a shocking year. The worst overall, if you go back to the Saturday, is actually Mediclinic, which is no longer in the index. That fell 51% as trading didn't turn around as quickly as hoped in Switzerland, remained weak in South Africa, and it was tarred with the emerging markets brush. Other big fallers were Micro Focus, Standard Life Aberdeen, acquisition concerns, I guess, there in terms of have they done the right thing.
And all the asset managers, have all been fairly rubbish.
They've had a horrid year, to be fair, yeah. And another weak performer has been Fresnillo, again, partly tied with emerging markets and concerns over what the new president, Mr. Labrador, is going to get up to.
Well, thanks for that summary. So let's have a look now at the FTSE 250. Now, as I said earlier, the FTSE 100 generally has performed better when sterling has been thumped, and the FTSE 250, which has got more domestic facing exposure, especially the retailers, has been the one that has been dragged down more. So overall, the worst performer was, in fact,
Yes, down 77%, which I'm sure is a source of great pain to Julian Dunkerton, the former CEO, who still owns quite a lot of the shares. And he's, I think, looking to try and come back, I believe, isn't he? So,
well, this is the problem with stocks that have a very charismatic chief executive who, when they leave the business or take a step back, things can...
Another one in the FTSE 100, one of the worst performers has been WPP, where Sir Martin Sorrell was pushed out, left, however you want to phrase it, back in the spring. And we it is easy for us all to buy into the cult of the chief executive officer. You know, the company that I work for, his name's on the door, is the name of the company. So, but it's something we need to be careful that the CEO can't do everything. They are one, but what they do when they're doing their job well is they set the tone and the culture, and they allocate capital. That's what they're there to do. What they can't do is absolutely everything. So they do have to learn to delegate. But if there is one person who is seen as, certainly, if you look over time, you do have to be careful if there's one person within a firm who seems to be particularly dominant managerially or creative force, WPP being a great example. Going back 10 years, RBS, perhaps you could argue, being another one.
Fred the Shred. So Superdry, the worst performer in the 250, then down 77%. But what are the other stinkers?
The other stinkers, I guess we could throw Carillion in as being the ultimate stinker, because that was in the 250 at the start of the year and it went to zero. So I suppose you could argue that was the worst. And actually, some of the other big losers are Kia and Capita. So the support services After Effects continue to rumble on. Though I should say that Bunzl, a support services stock, is one of the best FTSE 100 performers. So support services doesn't have to be all bad, all but of a different type. Oh, the shocker, Jupiter, fund management company. So again, we talked about that. And Thomas Cook down lost nearly three quarters of its value this year after multiple profit warnings and difficulty. There's again whether you could argue with perhaps a high profile CEO, Mr. Frankhauser.
And as for the winners on the FTSE 250.
Hikma, up 67%, went through a very difficult period a couple of years ago, but there seems to be gathering confidence that its pipeline is filling up nicely again, and sales growth looks to have started to start. Plus 500, I guess, has come through a bit of a regulatory storm, and I guess is possibly a beneficiary of what market volatility we've seen this year. And another bid company, Jardine Light Thompson, which got a bid from Marsh & McLennan of America, about a £4 billion bid. So that was another bid story that if you pick the right ones, you did manage to cash out this year.
Yeah, so again, showing us that M&A really has been one of the biggest drivers for stock-picking investors.
As you would perhaps expect, with sterling being weak, if you're an overseas asset buyer, you would perhaps look at the UK and think, well, I've got a cheap currency, a stock market that's lagged horribly over the last 18 to 24 months. You would kind of like to think there'd be some value here, but whether current political concerns or other are putting people off from nipping. But you have seen, you know, Shire's been bid for, Smurfit Kappa, there was a failed bid, Hammerson, there was a failed bid, successful bid, Sky, GK. So people have definitely sniffed around and somebody seems to think there's a bit of value here.
So holding that thought, I know it's impossible to make predictions about the year ahead with all the Brexit chaos, which is, the country seems to be falling around about our ears at the moment. But how do you think 2019 could turn out for UK investors?
The one thing that interests me, and it caught my eye, was a quote in your paper, and somebody described the UK as uninvestable. Which immediately makes me think I should be really, really interested in this. Because, you know, the time of greatest pessimism, the darkest hour tends to come before the dawn. So you can argue this pound is undervalued. Economists keep telling me it is. If you think that analyst estimates are even vaguely credible with the UK, or the FTSE 100 on about 11 times earnings with a yield of just under 5%, you kind of have to think that it's cheap. You kind of have to think that it's unloved. And so it might not take a vast amount to surprise on the upside next year. So if the US starts to weaken, it's going to be very difficult for the UK to go up. But I can see the UK doing an awful lot better on a relative basis than it has done in the past 2 or 3 years. And with an even vaguely fair wind, I can see it surprising on the upside just because it's so universally disliked.
Well, thank you very much there to Russ Mould. We'll definitely get you back on the podcast next year in 2019. Pleasure. If you would like to read more about this, FT Money this weekend has an article on the FTSE 100 and 250 runners and riders and our investment outlook for 2019, featuring predictions from Merrin Somerset Webb, who you heard from earlier, plus Richard Buxton of Merrion Global Investors and Mike McKenzie of This Parish. You can read those online now if you turn to ft.com/money. If you have a dispute with a company, is it better to complain to the Ombudsman, or should you proceed straight to the Small Claims Court? This is a dilemma that Lindsay Cook, our Money Mentor columnist, has been covering this year, and her latest column relays the personal experiences of canny FT Money readers who have said the famous words, "I'll see you in court." She joins me now in the studio. Welcome, Lindsay.
Good morning.
So, increasingly, people are turning to the Small Claims Court to resolve their disputes.
Yes, I've been surprised. I've had quite a number of letters from people who've been disappointed with ombudsman services because they've been turned down. And then I started looking, and the best response is the Financial Ombudsman Service, that a third of people win their cases. And quite a few people feel they start with the ombudsman and they think, I have right on my side. I'm not going to let this go. And they find out that they can take a case to the Small Claims Court quite easily, and there is a higher success rate than there is with most of the ombudsman services. Now, I see the ombudsman services as a dry run, unless they're one of the ones that take a year to see your case through. But we've had lots and lots of emails and correspondence from people about their successes in the Small Claims Court.
And before we go into some of the detail of the successes, which frankly did make me chuckle when I read it last weekend, the actual process of going to court, you would think, oh, it's a nightmare, I've got to pay for a solicitor, fill in endless paperwork. Actually, Small Claims Court is a doddle.
Yes, don't need a solicitor. Online claims start at £25, paper ones at £35, and that's for claims up to £300. And then they increase with the size of the claim. If it is small claims, it has to be under £10,000. There is a similar hearing fee if it does reach the court, but the vast majority are resolved without reaching the court. People put a claim in. Companies don't want to be dragged through the court and it look as if they can't afford something. It may be that a minor employee or minion has decided something that is wrong And they say, oh, no, we should be doing that. And an awful lot of people get a very quick turnaround.
Yeah, well, I could imagine lots of companies just don't have the capacity to pursue these claims, so they just pay to make them go away. Let's talk now about a wonderful FT Money reader, Benjamin Damaser, who wrote into you after claiming that he's made 19 successful claims through the Small Claims Court this year. And in your column last week, you related some of these. So tell us about the accident with his trousers.
They weren't all claims this year, but the accident with his trousers was he was travelling on a train and the steward pouring his coffee poured it badly and it went all over his trousers. And the steward said, oh, company will pay for that, sir. Here's who you contact. So he contacted them and he heard nothing. And so he thought, if the steward hadn't said that, I'd probably just put it down to nothing. But now I'm talking with head office and I'm cross. So he pursued them and they just ignored him. So he put a claim in and he ended up, it was decided that they should pay for new trousers and he got his fees back. His better one was when he was parking in a hotel that he stayed at and they clamped his car and he had business meetings. He had to get his son to school or something else. And so he used taxis, kept the receipts. They ignored him. Took it to court. The court found in his favour and he was going to get £250. They ignored it. So he put a bailiff onto the hotel.
I love this.
And the bailiff arrived during one of this summer's World Cup games and started dismantling the television. They found the cash straight away, which was the cash for what he was claiming, his fees and expenses. And he got that in a couple of days.
Well, fantastic. And if you're listening, Mr. Damaser, thank you so much for sending in your stories, which have provided much mirth and cheer in the Brexit-battered FT office. But, Lindsay, another example that you used in your column was Claire McDonald. Now, her neighbour was doing something that I know many of us dread, a basement dig-down. And this caused her considerable distress.
Yeah, she had a party wall agreement, as did a couple of her other neighbours, and this work was loud and noisy, but it damaged her sitting room. Not structural damage, cracks in walls, so it wasn't to the standards that she wanted. So she tried to talk to the neighbour, and he said, oh, get a solicitor, do it through the party wall. And she found out that was likely to cost her up to
£15,000.
So she put in a claim online through the Small Claims Court and she printed it off and gave it to him. Next morning, she had a cheque for the £3,000 she was asking for. Now, I think she lives in a nice house because I think it would cost me less than that to decorate.
Well, I was going to say, what was she using? Bloody gold leaf?
some of our readers have said, 3,000? Good grief, you can buy a house for that in Wigan. But others have said, oh, no, in southwest London, that's quite a modest amount.
Yeah, so use lark's tongues to to pay for their walls in South London. Well, thank you very much to Lindsay Cook, our money mentor columnist. You can read her column online now at ft.com/money. And don't forget, we always want to hear about dilemmas that you may be fighting with a particular company. You can get in touch with Lindsay on her dedicated FT email address, which is money.mentor@ft.com. Or if you want to speak to one of the other experts at FT Money, our general email address is money@ft.com. We're taking a Christmas break for our sins, so we'll be back with the next podcast on Thursday, the 3rd of January, with a specially themed podcast all about what financial New Year's resolutions we are all making. But you still have time to tell us about yours. If you go to ft.com/New Year, there's a short form that you can fill in, and we may even use your comments on the next podcast. But for now, we wish all of our readers a very merry Christmas and a profitable New Year in 2019. Goodbye.
Spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your $1 a month trial today at shopify.com/records.